the headlines. The Taliban capture Lashkargah in southwestern Afghanistan as the U.S. and Britain deploy thousands of troops to the country to evacuate their nationals. The United Nations warns that Afghanistan is on the brink of a humanitarian catastrophe as Taliban advances have forced tens of thousands to flee their homes. And Russia reports 815 new deaths from the coronavirus, recording its highest daily fatality since the start of the pandemic. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half-hour, Taliban militants say they've captured Lashkargah, the capital of Helmand province in southern Afghanistan. A security source has confirmed the news, saying military and government officials had evacuated Lashkargah after striking a deal with the Taliban. The militants have seized over a dozen provincial capitals since last Friday as they press ahead with their offensive across Afghanistan. The group is estimated to be in control of nearly two-thirds of the country. The capital, Kabul, remains in the hands of the government. Thousands of civilians have already fled there as the Taliban took key cities one by one. Meanwhile, the U.S. and U.K. say they're deploying thousands of troops to help evacuate their nationals and diplomats leaving Afghanistan. Earlier, our Kabul correspondent Amin Alimi said the Taliban have captured the city of Pola Alam, located just 65 kilometers south of the Afghan capital.
After capturing Lashkargah, Pule Alam and also Kalat was other two cities that were captured by the Taliban militants. Pule Alam is the capital city of Lugar province, located just 65 kilometers south of Kabul. And Kalat is another city in southern Zabul province of Afghanistan, and it connects Ghazni province to the southern Kandahar. As well as the Taliban militants are currently engaging in fightings with Afghan security forces across some other provinces, including mainly Maidan Wardak in southwest of Kabul, Kapisa in north of Kabul, Parwan north of Kabul, and again and in some parts of Nangarhar and Lagman provinces in eastern Afghanistan. In the meantime, some of the provinces have so far been collapsed or been captured by the Taliban under what the people of Afghanistan, what the critics of the war policy of the Afghan government name it, secret deal between Afghan government, local officials and the Taliban militants. For instance, the Taliban took control over the cities of Aibak, Ghazni, Faizabad, Saripul, Pule Alam and Kalat without facing any resistance by Afghan security forces. And even in a case, the governor of Ghazni province handed over the entire city to the Taliban without exchanging of fire between Afghan security forces and them there.
UN agencies have warned of a humanitarian catastrophe in Afghanistan amid growing violence and instability that have escalated the suffering of millions of people in the war-torn country. The World Food Programme said the worst is yet to come, and the larger tide of hunger is fast approaching. The UN Refugee Agency also said more than 250,000 people, mostly women and children, have been forced from their homes since May. A shelter crisis is also looming in Afghanistan. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs said thousands of people are fleeing from rural areas to the capital, Kabul, and other urban centers in search of shelter. It said people are sleeping in the open in parks and public spaces. The World Health Organization also reported a doubling of trauma cases in the last 2 to 3 months and expressed concerns about shortages of medical supplies. Iran has called on the Taliban to ensure the safety of diplomats and diplomatic facilities in the Afghan city of Herat. The call followed a Taliban announcement that they have gained control over the city. The Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman said his country is in regular contact with its consulate in Herat and follow up the condition of the staff there. Said Khatibzad also expressed concern about the escalation of violence in Afghanistan and the condition of civilians. He urged the Taliban to ensure their safety. Herat is Afghanistan's third largest city and fell to the Taliban on Thursday. Palestinians have condemned Israel's plans for building over 2,000 new settler units in the occupied West Bank. Earlier in our news review program, we discussed the issue with our guests. Let's take a listen. The
Palestinian president strongly condemns Israeli plans to build over 2,000 new settler units. In the occupied West Bank, President Mahmoud Abbas's office rejected the move, saying it contradicted the U.S. position President Joe Biden expressed in a call with his Palestinian counterpart. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry also condemned the move as aimed at grabbing more Palestinian land and consolidating Israel's settler colonialism. The regime's new plans come despite international criticism against its settlement expansions. In July, a UN human rights investigator said Israeli settlement activity in the occupied West Bank amounts to a war crime. All Israeli settlements are deemed illegal under international law. To discuss this issue a little bit further, I'm going to bring in dear guests from Ramallah. Amal Wahdan joins us. She's an activist and out of London via Skype. Professor Kent Farrow, he is the professor of media and philosophy. Professor, it's always good to have you with us on the show. I'm going to begin, I guess, with Madame Wahdan in Ramallah itself to perhaps get her reaction on this latest series of settlement building. I'm sorry to say that this is not news, really, of Israelis wanting to build settler units in those areas, but you know, the fact that they keep going on despite, you know, the UN reports, the condemnations, and, you know, still going with impunity, I guess that is the issue of significance here. Wouldn't you agree?
Oh yes, sure. Of course, this doesn't need only condemnation by the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. It needs more actions on the ground first, and he needs to exert more pressure diplomatically, politically, and in the UN Security Council as well. We can go as far as the ICC, since all these war crimes must be fought and must be stood against. Now they are. This is a new wave, actually, of attacking the essential part of the Palestinian state. You know, if, Mahmoud Abbas believes that with the two-state solution. So this endangers even his vision for a two-state solution. It's actually taking most of the land. We only have like 10% of the land. If we take out the sea areas, what they call sea areas under the Oslo efforts, this means that he's Mahmoud Abbas is going to be a president on a 10% of the historic, you know, historic Palestine. And if we look at what's going on in Jerusalem, in Sheikh Jarrah, and in Silwan, and the settlement, the land settlement project, this means that the Palestinian state again is going to be without its capital in East Jerusalem. So actually, the president is losing everything on the ground, and he keeps doing the same thing that he used to do. Mm. And this is not acceptable. He needs to escalate the popular resistance, as he prefers to go ahead in fighting the colonialism project in the West Bank. He needs to also increase or change his tone towards the USA. The USA actually keeps giving us promises, empty words, but they're not going to exert any pressure against the Israelis,
yeah,
and they will keep covering up their crimes.
Yeah, on those empty words notes, I'm just going to hand it over to Professor Farrow in London. Professor, what do you think about this? You know, the fact that President Abbas has condemned this, you know, I sometimes wonder what cards does he have to play, really, other than these words. And, you know, like he or his office says, you know, that the fact that the conversation that he has had with Joe Biden really was something otherwise, you know, and you know, the result is coming out totally different. What do you think?
Well, I don't think you can consider the destination of a people based on the conversation between Abbas and Biden. I think the issue here, and I completely agree with my colleague in terms of the need to take these issues to the International Criminal Court, because these are war crimes. And more than that, this is the continuing ethnic cleansing of Palestine. people need to remember that in 1948, 80% of the population, of the Palestinian population of Palestine, were displaced or fled. 80%. And since then, the remaining 20% and people in exile have been pushed around. I mean, Abbas is in between a rock and a hard place, but he's losing the rock and the hard place. And I think we're in a position now internationally where there really has to be much more pressure. And I'm quite hopeful in terms of the situation with international attention on Palestine, particularly from young people, and particularly their political position in terms of the rejection of the two-state solution, which we're getting a lot of information on from around the world, not just in Palestine and the Middle East, but internationally as well. So I think these are important developments that need to be encouraged. So I think a focus on war crimes at the International Criminal Court and also the escalation of international pressure on Israel to not just stop these plans, but to roll back what's happened before and to go much, much further, as people are suggesting.
Professor Ken Farrow, Professor of Media and Philosophy out of London via Skype. Thank you very much. Madame Amal Wahdan, Palestinian activist in Ramallah, thank you very much as well for participating in this discussion.
Welcome back. Russia has recorded 850 new deaths from COVID-19, the highest daily fatality rate since the pandemic began. The latest figure brings to over 168,000 the number of total virus deaths in Russia. The health ministry also announced more than 22,200 new daily cases on Friday. Russia has been grappling with a third wave of the disease since mid-June. The authorities blame the resurgence on the highly contagious Delta variant. 42% of the Russian population has been fully vaccinated, but independent polls show that 55% of Russians do not plan on getting a jab. China has rejected the World Health Organization's calls for a renewed probe into the origins of COVID-19, Beijing says the calls are politically motivated. On Thursday, the WHO urged China to share raw data from the earliest COVID cases to revive its probe into the origins of the disease. The organization carried out a first investigation in January when its team visited the Chinese city of Wuhan. That's where the first global infections emerged. In its report, the WHO said it was, quote, extremely unlikely that a lab leak caused the pandemic, but it failed to conclude how the virus began. Now China says that same report should be the basis of a future global traceability work. Australia's state of New South Wales has reported its biggest daily rise of coronavirus cases since the start of the pandemic. Officials warn that infections could surge in the coming days.
We had, unfortunately, 390 cases of community transmission. Some are still under investigation, but at least 60 of those have been infectious in the community. And I anticipate, given the large number of cases we've had in the last few days, that unfortunately this trend will continue for at least the next few days.
The authorities also reported two new deaths. They bring to 38 the total fatalities from the latest outbreak in New South Wales. The state's capital, Sydney, is the hardest hit. Infections have spiked there despite a nearly seven-week lockdown. The restrictions were imposed after a Delta-driven outbreak in the city in mid-June. The virus has even spread to other parts of Australia, prompting officials to impose similar curbs. On Friday, the capital, Canberra, entered its first day of a week-long lockdown after it reported two cases. The lockdown is the first there in more than a year. And Iran has logged more than 39,000 new COVID-19 infections, bringing the country's total caseload to nearly 4.4 million. The health ministry also confirmed 527 new COVID-related deaths for the past day. The country's total death toll from the virus is now inching closer to 97,000. More than 7,000 COVID patients are currently in intensive care units. Iran has been grappling with a fifth wave of the pandemic for weeks. The surge is largely blamed on the Delta variant of the virus. More than 330 cities are now designated as red, the highest category on Iran's coronavirus risk scale. COVID restrictions are in place in those cities to curb the outbreak. Nearly 14.5 million people have received the first dose of a COVID vaccine nationwide. More than 3.6 million have so far been fully inoculated. Sudan's government has decided to hand over ousted President Omar al-Bashir to the International Criminal Court, along with other officials wanted over the Darfur conflict. Bashir has been wanted for more than a decade over charges of genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity in the Sudanese region. Mohamed Ali Fazari has more on this report.
Sudan has officially agreed to hand over ousted President Omar al-Bashir to the International Criminal Court, along with other officials wanted over the Darfur conflict. The International Criminal Court chief prosecutor held talks with Sudanese officials in accelerating practical steps to hand over those wanted by the court over alleged atrocities committed in Darfur.
I'm pleased to announce that the reason I was late was I was signing a memorandum of understanding with the government of Sudan that was signed by me as the prosecutor and by the Minister of Justice.
Al-Bashir is currently in Khobar prison in the Sudanese capital. He was dismissed and arrested in April 2019 following a massive popular protest movement against him. ICC Chief Prosecution Karim Khan said he will accomplish his mission in order to meet the expectations of the international community, especially with regard to Security Council resolutions to achieve justice about the victims of Darfur. Last week, the Sudanese cabinet approved Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court in what was considered as a new step towards trying al-Bashir before this international judicial body in The Hague. In 2009, the International Criminal Court issued an arrest warrant for al-Bashir, accusing him of committing war crimes and crimes against humanity during the armed conflicts in Darfur that erupted in 2003 and killed more than 300,000 people.
The Sudanese government decision to ratify the Rome Statute will make the government closer to international justice. But as observers say, it also divides the political parties in the country for and against. Mohamed Ali Fazari, Khartoum.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Muharram Special. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Imam Hussein, peace upon him, staged his uprising to revive the Prophet's practice and confront evilness. He sacrificed his life and all his belongings to safeguard human values and spirituality. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, says, O people, this Hussein is the son of Ali. Recognize him. I swear by the one which my soul is in his hand, that he and his lovers and lovers of his lovers will be in paradise. Imam Hussein's aim of uprising was to safeguard the divine values and protect the traditions of the Prophet of Islam. He spared no effort to revive the forgotten values of Islam. That's why the Muslim scholars believe that Islam owed its foundation to Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, and survival to Imam Hussein, peace upon him. Ignorance and oppression had covered the Islamic rules like dust after the passing away of the Prophet. The martyrdom of Imam Hussein and his loyal companions removed this dust and demonstrated the real image of Islam. This is what we read in Ziyarat, or standard form of salutation to Imam Hussein. I bear testimony that you indeed maintained the prayer and enjoined what is good and forbade what is evil. Basically, enjoining what is good and forbidding what is evil have a very high position in the culture of the Ahlul Bayt, or the progeny of the Prophet. Imam Ali, peace upon him, calls this obligatory act as superior to jihad, or a struggle in the way of God. He says, all good deeds and jihad in the way of God before enjoining what is good and forbidding what is evil are like a drop before a turbulent and vast sea. Imam Hussein believed that he had to support Islamic values with all his being. His personality was the incarnation of steadfastness and freedom. He staged his uprising to show to mankind that he would never surrender to oppression under any circumstances. He would never compromise with the despotic and licentious rulers of Umayyad regime. He used to quote these words from his father, Imam Ali. The most unjust man is the one who promotes traditions of oppression in the society and destroys just traditions. Imam Hussein, peace upon him, had an iron will. In response to his brother, Muhammad Hanafiye, who had proposed some peaceful ways for him to avoid military confrontation with Yazid, the Imam said, my brother, if there remains no refuge and safe haven on the earth, I will never swear allegiance with Yazid, son of Muawiyah. In the sublime culture of Imam Hussein,
humility and submission before untruth and injustice has no place. His word keeps resonating in the ears of history when he said, "Beware that the illegitimate brat, the son of the illegitimate brat, Ubaydullah, son of Ziyad, has forced me to choose one of the two, either death or humility." How humility is far from us. God, his apostle, the faithful, the chaste lads, the valorous people, and the people of the noble world do not accept from us to prefer the obedience of the base to death with dignity. Imam Hussein, peace upon him, sacrificed his blood to dignify Islam and the school of the Ahlul Bayt. In Karbala, he depicted the picture of self-sacrifice and safeguarding the pristine Islamic values. His uprising caused wise people to become more aware of oppression and corruption. He made them move against injustice rather than being indolent and inactive. After the epic of Ashura, many people staged uprisings to avenge Imam's blood. For instance, Mukhtar Saqafi staged a great uprising whereby he killed many of the perpetrators of Karbala. In the contemporary era too, revolutions and movements have been staged through taking the pattern of Ashura and Imam Hussein's uprising. Imam Hussein, peace upon him, staged his uprising to expose the tarnished image of Islam that Yazid and his cohorts had depicted of this religion. He fought against Yazid knowing that he and all his 72 companions would be slain. He taught us that we should sacrifice whatever we have to preserve the divine values and God's religion.
We get people.
U.S. voter suppression.
The partisanship in the United States is tending towards the extremes. For centuries, the U.S. has branded itself as a proponent of democracy, meaning officials are elected by citizens' votes. But today, voting rights are threatened across the U.S. as the GOP is vying to control elections in multiple states.
What's the interest of the Arizona RNC here in keeping, say, the out-of-precinct ballot disqualification rules on the books?
Because it puts us at a competitive disadvantage relative to Democrats. Politics is a zero-sum game.
On the other hand, Democrats are trying to avert the control through the House as well as bills with expansive provisions. Hello and welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Mila Javan Mardi. In this episode, we will take you inside the complicated effort to restrict voting in America, from voting by mail to early voting, ID requirements, and all the other attempts to target the bedrock of democracy. And we will try to answer the question, can U.S. democracy survive? Stay with us.
Republicans in the Georgia General Assembly are trying to change the rules of the election here in Georgia. Rules that you wrote. because you were handed defeat in November the 3rd and again on January the 5th. And you know your only chance at winning future elections is to prevent eligible Georgians from casting their ballots and having their voices heard.
Republicans who hold majority of power at the state level across the United States are doing their best to change electoral laws in their own favor. This time, they're simply making it harder for everyone to vote, particularly minorities and people of color who tend to vote Democrat.
Being told in American politics in recent weeks has been that the states are involved in a systematic effort to suppress the vote. Those arguments are being made by people who obviously haven't read any of these new state laws, because that's not happening.
We call on our colleagues on the other side of the aisle. You still have an opportunity to stand on the right side of history. You still can do the right thing and know that this is not the difference between left and right. This is the difference between right and wrong.
No matter who did this, we would stand here to be fighting it, because the right to vote is sacred. So those who tend to say it's just another fight between Democrats and Republicans are missing the point.
The Biden administration has so far failed to protect voting rights in America. Democratic efforts to pass voting rights legislation in Washington have stalled in the evenly divided Senate. Republicans filibustered the broad elections overhaul known as For the People Act, and they also managed to stall the other voting rights measure, the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, named for a former Georgia congressman and civil rights activist.
The GOP is seeking a lower turnout in the next rounds of election, as they know a huge turnout by the people would get a Democrat elected. Therefore, laws restricting a voter turnout are being introduced, and in some cases, passed across the country. Our first guest today is radio talk show host and political analyst Garland Nixon, an outspoken civil libertarian and First Amendment advocate, and currently serving on the National Board of Directors for the American Civil Liberties Union. Thank you for joining us, sir.
Thank you for inviting me.
Garland, how do Republicans justify attempts the Democrats allege are aimed at restricting voting in the United States?
Well, we are really at interesting times in the United States, because in the past, the GOP has at least made a minimum effort to justify their moves to restrict voting. However, now we're looking at simply brute force efforts. There's no even attempt to justify it in many instances. So in the past, the discussion was, well, we should have identification so we would know who's voting, and we should stop people from voting more than once.
Many thanks for your insights. We'll hear more of your analysis later on in the program.
The United States seems to be at the onset of a new era of voter suppression. In Texas, as well as several other battleground states, Republicans have passed substantial overhauls of their election laws and enacted new voting restrictions this year. Since January, at least 22 bills that make voting more difficult have been signed into law in at least 14 states. The scale of voter suppression this time round is incomparable to the previous round in 2011. But the full impact of the latest voter suppression measures is yet to come into full view.
Mr. Speaker, House Bill 531 is designed to begin to bring back the confidence of our voters back into our election system.
It does not make voting more secure. It only makes voting more difficult. Does removing multiple weekends of weekend voting make our elections more secure? Does shortening early voting make our weekends elections more secure? Does invalidating provisional ballots make our elections more secure? The answer is no.
The laws adopt various tactics to suppress votes. They make it difficult to vote by mail or earlier than the election date. They even impose harsher voter ID requirements and make it easier to call a ballot faulty. Yet some of the bills are mixed and even contain expansive provisions to complicate the matter further. We're now joined by Gerald Horn, Professor of African American Studies at the University of Houston. Welcome to the show, sir. Let me ask you this. How do you assess the political situation in the near future, considering the GOP's attempt to use legal potentials to restrict voting in its own favor?
Well, it's very difficult to say right now. Certainly in a number of states, for example, Texas, where I am now sitting, the state legislature has moved aggressively to circumscribe voting rights. The same is true for a number of other states, particularly in the South. At the same time, at the national level, the federal level in Washington, D.C., you see that attempts to push through voting rights legislation is meeting a roadblock in the form of Republican legislators.
Many thanks, Gerald. We'll hear more of your analysis later on in the program as well.
The Republicans are down in the polls and have lost popularity, at least at the governmental level. A historic turnout in the 2020 presidential election stripped the GOP of any power. Donald Trump and the Republicans lost the White House, they lost control of the U.S. Senate, and failed to gain back control of the House of Representatives in the November 2020 election.
The CEO and chairman of Coca-Cola said organizations like ours must stand up and support Black Lives Matter and social justice. Now when they try to pass this racist legislation, we can't get him to say anything.
Well, you know, it's interesting. We were at the State House today protesting against this legislation. A group of faith leaders met with the lieutenant governor to discuss this matter. Then we tried to have a meeting with the governor, whose office said he was busy and couldn't meet.
30 laws have already been passed to restrict voting, and 400 other bills are moving. Republican-controlled state legislature simply aimed to make it harder to take part in elections by reducing the number of those eligible to vote. Has there been a similar situation where members of a political party try to change the electoral laws in their own favor in order to win elections? Or is this an unprecedented effort to suppress voters in America?
As a Black person living in America, the way I see it is there has not been a situation where that wasn't going on. If you look at the beginning of America, ever since that voting was allowed, it was restricted, you know, by economic class, certainly always restricted by race because of the enslavement of Black people. After enslavement, for most of the period of time, there were various, what was called in America, Jim Crow laws, which were laws that were deliberately intended to stop Black people from voting. Things like poll taxes, where if you were Black, you had to pay to vote, where they would have literally, they would have tests such as a jar full of jelly beans, and a Black person had to guess the number of jelly beans, and of course they didn't know and they didn't care the number of jelly beans. Whichever number the Black person guessed was the wrong number and they couldn't vote.
Like at the end of the Obama era, the GOP is finding their chances of winning power back quite slim. The situation obliges them to take immediate action to make sure they have a share in the power play of the near future.
The Constitution is pretty clear about what is supposed to happen now. When there is a vacancy on the Supreme Court, the President of the United States is to nominate someone. The fact that it's that hard that we're even discussing this is, I think, a measure of how, unfortunately, the venom and rancor in Washington has prevented us from getting basic work done. Now, this would be a good moment for us to rise above that.
The American public's access to vote is in unprecedented peril. More laws are being passed by state legislatures, controlled by Republicans, requiring strict identification for voting or banning mail voting and early voting. And what will be the fate of democracy in the United States?
Once again, I hate to sound pessimistic, but right now things don't look very good. I'm sure you know that on January 6, 2021, a mob of pro-Trump supporters sought to prevent the transfer of power to the winner of the November 2020 election, speaking of Joseph R. Biden. They were armed to the teeth. They barely failed in that effort. And as of now, the Republicans are trying to prevent an investigation of that insurrection, they are claiming that those who were arrested are actually political prisoners who should be treated more kindly by the authorities.
Changing the law to limit the people's say has been on the agenda for long. Back in 2011, a backlash from the country's first black president pushed Republicans to take similar decisions, each red state ensuring a low turnout against Democratic interests. Yet, this year's voter suppression outweighs the 2011 voter restriction.
Now, there's been a lot of litigation about voter identification laws and whether or not they're discriminatory. And for the most part, the courts have been mixed. They look at the particular jurisdiction, they look at the kinds of identification that are available to voters, they look at whether or not it's a strict or non-strict regime, whether it's a photo or non-photo regime, and depending on the evidence, what political science there is or what the recent electoral history is, courts have come out on both sides of the question. In some circumstances saying that the voter identification laws aren't discriminatory, and other places say they place too great a burden on certain populations of the public or maybe the voter public as a whole.
This is the most aggressive wave of voter suppression the U.S. has seen, at least in the past decade. It is the fruit of repeated allegations about voter fraud, a shadow campaign launched by former President Trump in the wake of his loss to secure a second tenure. But are Democrats any better?
But when it comes to actually taking legal action, when it comes to actually taking legislative action, I don't see the Democratic Party doing much, simply the Biden administration, simply because if you look at how Joe Biden got elected, one of the things that the Democratic Party had to do is act collectively as a party to thwart democracy. They acted collectively as a party to stop Bernie Sanders from being a legitimate and viable candidate. The Democratic Party has acted in many instances in a way to thwart democracy. So in the Democratic primaries, the Democratic Party uses all manner of trickery and chicanery to ensure that no one who would oppose the mainstream establishment Democratic narrative, the imperialist narrative, is available for the voters in the general election.
The backlash from Barack Obama's presidency led to a business tycoon winning the race to the White House. Now, former President Donald Trump keeps alleging that the 2020 election was stolen from him, although he and his team have failed to produce any evidence of significant voter fraud.
This is going to be a fraud like you've never seen.
The only way we're going to lose this election is if the election is rigged.
Donald Trump's popularity, at least among Republicans, remains high, and his false allegations about a stolen election and rampant voter fraud are the driving force for the latest round of voter suppression. Some of the voter suppression measures that are being pushed by the Republicans include banning 24-hour voting and drive-through voting, prohibiting election officials from proactively sending absentee ballot applications to voters who had not requested them, adding new voter identification requirements for voting by mail, limiting the assistance that can be provided to voters, and greatly expand the authority and autonomy of partisan poll watchers.
Founded in 1854, the GOP has been one of the two major contemporary political parties in the United States. But today, the proponents of the party appear to be in the minority. They are rushing to counter liberal policies promoted by leftist politicians and mainstream media, which have been gaining momentum since Barack Obama took power in the 2008 election.
I want to thank every American who participated in this election. Whether you voted for the very first time or waited in line for a very long time. By the way, we have to fix that. Whether you pounded the pavement or picked up the phone. Whether you held an Obama sign or a Romney sign, you made your voice heard.
states with strong conservative lean are afraid of the rising tide of political correctness by the left. They don't like globalist ideas, open borders, and anticipate the toppling of white power in America.
In Georgia, there is a law passed that if people are standing in line to vote, and the voting lines can be up to 8 hours because of the very restrictive opportunities to get to the polls, fewer polls, fewer machines, etc. But in the event that someone's standing in line in the heat, it is illegal to give bottled water to the people who are standing in line. Well, it would be very difficult to find a reasonable justification for that other than simply trying to discourage people from standing in line for a long time. So I think desperate times call for desperate measures, and we've gotten to a point where the GOP in many instances have gone so far over the top in their voter restriction laws that they're not even trying, not even making a minimum effort to make an excuse for it. They're just using the power that they have in these particular states to enforce voter restrictions in any way that they can.
Democrats are moving to counter attempts to restrict voting rights, in part by introduction of voter right legislation. Some 28 bills with expansive voter rights have been signed this year, and at least 115 similar bills are moving in local legislatures. The Democrats in the House of Representatives are also attempting to push the For the People Act, although so far without much success.
When Donald Trump told a lie, a big lie, that the election was stolen from him by fraud, by voter fraud, and in response to Donald Trump's lies, Republican state legislatures immediately launched the most sweeping voter suppression efforts in at least 80 years. More than 250 bills in 43 states were introduced just between the months of January and February that would restrict the right to vote. Today, there are nearly 400 bills. And in states like Georgia, Florida, Iowa, and Montana, these bills have become law.
The For the People Act supposedly emphasizes on the expansion of voting rights. It also tries to reduce influence of money in politics by changing campaign finance laws. Liberals controlling the Congress also aim to restrict partisan gerrymandering.
I'm afraid to say that this is nothing new in the United States of America. Recall that when slavery ended in 1865, that is to say the enslavement of black people, there was an attempt to ensure that black men in particular had the right to vote. This went as far as changing the Constitution. But as time passed, those efforts fell by the wayside, and we saw that through a reign of terror that the anti-black forces were able to strip away the right of black people to vote.
Enacting restrictions or expansion of voter rights is on the agenda of lawmakers from both sides of the aisle across the country. As former President Donald Trump keeps fanning flames of partisanship and divisive policies in America, the result has been the silencing of the voice of voters and reducing their say in decisions made by politicians.
We think the election will be very secure without fraud. Certainly, when you mail someone a ballot, there's always a risk that someone in the family or a friend or somebody could vote for that person and mail it back to us. But we don't see a widespread problem at all.
We've done everything we can to minimize the opportunities for somebody to tamper with the boxes themselves and whatever's inside the box during election season.
The former president and his supporters have not been convinced that the 2020 race was a fair and square one. Some of them believe Trump is soon coming back. The former president has come out of shadows after leaving the White House, insisting he's the winner, while enjoying support from the majority of the Republicans.
America is so divided at this point that the two sides that we are accustomed to, the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, are going to make the same accusations regardless of what happens after any election, that the other side cheated, that they didn't fairly win, that there was an outside entity. In 2016, we had the Democrats lose and accuse Russia of interfering in various absurd ways, such as there were Facebook, they went to Congress and argued that Facebook pages with pictures of puppies were used by the Republicans to interfere with the election.
How the Republican-Democratic voting rights conflict may be resolved is yet to be seen. Donald Trump's legal problems, his eponymous companies under criminal indictment in New York, could complicate a second run at the presidency. Donald Trump is being pressured by several lawsuits targeting his businesses. He's also under investigation for possible tax evasion. There are also suggestions that Donald Trump's family members are distancing themselves from the former president.
Oh, well, you know, fringe benefits, it's complicated, it's not clear. Taxes, it's not clear. This is way over the line, and that spreadsheet is absolutely a smoking spreadsheet. Keeping two sets of books, I mean, the spreadsheet was basically keeping track of how much compensation he was receiving off the books so that he wouldn't be overpaid, but not reporting it to the IRS or to New York State tax authorities. And two sets of books is actually what the overall investigation is about as well. The overall investigation, which is much larger than this issue, is apparently looking into questions about whether or not the Trump Organization was sending one set of valuations for its properties to tax authorities and yet another set of more inflated valuations to insurance companies and to banks for lending and insurance purposes.
With or without Trump, the GOP needs to have a stronger ground in the 2024 presidential election. That's why it spares no efforts to ensure it can have the upper hand when the time comes. But will anything be left of the so-called democracy? Let's see. I'm your host, Mila Javamardi. Be sure to tune in next week when we come back with another episode of We the People.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
Thank you. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.